You're listening to Gamesform's Mobilize and Monetize podcast. Dive into the world of mobile gaming with us as we explore the latest trends and discuss best practices.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Gamesform's Mobilize and Monetize podcast. Now, I just told my guest that I am so, so excited to have him on, and honestly quite honored. So joining me today is none other than Sagi Schleser, who is CEO and founder of Crazy Lab. Sagi, so great to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited as well. So I like talking about gaming and monetization.
Absolutely. So we've got a really, really great conversation, loads and loads of interesting questions. And before we kick things off, I actually want to say a massive congratulations, because as everyone knows in the mobile gaming industry, Crazy Labs has actually crossed the 7 billion download mark. So massive congratulations to you and the team, Sagi. That's a huge, huge accomplishment.
Yeah, it's never planned that this would happen. But, you know, as we accumulated more and more and we saw we're highly downloadable, snackable. So, yeah, it's just we're very proud to be one of the only. I mean, there are a few companies with this size, but we're one of the very few to reach so many people. So
absolutely. Such an exciting time for you guys. And we're going to get into that a little bit more, but I want to kick things off because we have got a lot to talk about. So my first question to you, Sagi, Crazy Labs has been a leader in the hyper-casual gaming space, as we all know. In your opinion, how has the genre sort of evolved since you guys have entered the market? And what role do you see it playing in the broader sort of mobile gaming ecosystem moving forward?
Well, hyper-casual, it started as super casual. So, right. So when we evolved in the past, we pivoted a few times, and one of the pivots was into super casual, which evolved into hyper-casual, which for many years, and I think at the core of it, because a lot of people said it's a bubble, it's not real gaming. So there were many, many views and critiques about it. And yeah, it was... It's ad-driven, still ad-driven, in large, not huge games that usually the retention is not the same, of course, as casual. So you have relatively high drop of players. But I think the main value, what happened is the revolution where people that are holding, these devices, they found out that it's not only a communication device for their social. And so it's actually... They're a gaming device, but they're not gamers. They don't want to play 2 hours every day to commit. Right. So what they want is to enjoy, and enjoyment came from the lack of commitment and your availability to play 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time, not to have to ponder about it now for 3 days if you're going to lose something, if you're not coming back.
Right.
And trend-like. So you use your social, whatever, your TikTok, your Instagram, your whatever, and then... You have something that kind of communicates with what happens there. And I think this is why hyper became so popular and grew year after year. But then, like any good industry, it came to saturation. So people downloaded in the billions hyper casual games. And if we look at the market right now, the market in terms of monetization, total addressable market, we see that hyper is now just, it's stabilized. It grows a little bit, but the main difference we see is that there are fewer. So if you look at the percentage of new games that come into the market, because it's now saturated, so it's a lot less than was, I don't know, 3 years ago. And so there was also the COVID era which helped a little bit. So right now you see 12% of the total pie of hyper-casual downloads and revenue. So 12% is in new games. Then if it was before, it was 50%. So obviously that made
quite a drop.
Yeah. And we, like, I think a lot of the market, we looked for where it's going to evolve. And so ever since Archero came out and everyone marked this unicorn, which was called hybrid, nobody knew really how it's going to work. The massive marketing like hyper, but the deep gaming like casual. But, you know, I think, this when a lot of smart people and other companies kind of doubled down on it. So we had 2 years where there were very few games and that really were hybrid. But now we see a hybrid growing. We see games that that have this longer monetization, hybrid monetization, in-apps and ads. And this is also where we are putting our focus right now. So we see today hyper-casual as residual to what happens on our main effort, which is in casual, where we do only fashion simulation, and in hybrid. So we might out of it get something which is hyper, but as a target, we don't try to hit the hyper market anymore.
Interesting. So I wanted to ask you, because there's so much talk about data, as we know, and you guys in Crazy Labs attribute much of its growth to data science and analytics. So can you share how these tools have sort of changed the way games are designed, in your opinion, tested, marketed in the mobile gaming industry? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think our whole world evolves and revolves through data, but just to be accurate, because data is just a tool. So I think the main thing with people is that they have to make out of information knowledge. And these are two completely different things. So we have this abundance of information, even too much sometimes. And the problem, and there is an ability to turn it into reports that you can also filter many filters and so on. I think the important thing is to understand your game and your players. And this is the key. So we ever increased our ability to send more events and, you know, level funnel and the economy of the game and churn and understand how different and A-B test between different versions and different variations within the game and the marketing. But I think to put everything in context, because I can give you an example. So in many cases, an analyst or producer or the game designer would come and say, listen, we have a big drop here in level 7. So we think the level is too hard. Let's make it lighter. Or at the same, we charge too much. We charge $9.99, $7.99. Let's make it cheaper. So this is a trend I've always seen, which, by the way, it's very intuitive, but usually things are counterintuitive in that sense. So in many cases, when you make the level easier, yes, you get more people to pass it, but then you get much lower, longer term retention because you kind of pissed off all the good players that really wanted the tight game that fits what they want. So this is information, and the way to turn it into knowledge is, again, to go and say, who are the players? What experience? Is it a Zen puzzle? Is it a puzzle where they need to feel smart? Is it a puzzle where they actually want to feel that they're solving it and they want to exercise some iterations and so on? So it really depends on what is the game, who is the audience. And yes, we rely heavily on the data, but then how to turn it into decisions and to knowledge, this is something that greatly evolved. Understanding the player, understanding the cohorts. So today you actually control the level of the campaign. Who did you bring in? Is it an in-app campaign? Is it a web browse campaign, a mixed campaign? So where is it? What is the geo? And then how do you then interpret the data in a way that actually helps you in the game? So it's overwhelming, I must say. And one of the things that is happening right now to try and help with this is obviously AI is coming predictive. The Gen AI is not helping in anything predictive, but it actually little by little helps you in giving much more accessibility from the producers and game owners and game designers into questions they just want to ask the data, and it shortens the cycle. Like today, you can ask ChatGPT or Claude, and then drill down, and it gives you a much faster response time into getting the answers you wanted. Before, you go to the analyst, he creates a report, or he looks at the SQL, he gets the data, he gives you an answer, then you need another and another, and it takes weeks, months, maybe days, if we were doing fast iteration. Now, some of these things, they can take minutes, or maybe a small amount of hours, but I think this is a huge evolution that is coming into that. All the reporting will move into this format, the Gen AI format. You will be able to kind of compose whatever you need and then pin it or not pin it, but you will not have to work with these huge reports that take a lot of time. And data is critical, and we see the needle is moving again. So very interesting for us.
Interesting stuff. So again, I can't stay away from this number. You guys have had 7 billion downloads and a massively diverse portfolio at that. So I wanted to ask you, as someone who's leading the company, how do you sort of balance scaling operations globally while maintaining the creativity that's needed to produce good games? I mean, at the end of the day, it is all about how good the game is to a certain extent as well.
Very difficult. Myself and my partner guy, so we sometimes, so we play the focused guy and the creative guy, and we
I like that, yeah.
So it's not that we have specific roles all the time. So if he's taking right. the creative part, I will take the more, but we need to focus. And if he takes, if I take the creative, I want to do a new game or let's do that, then he will be the focus guy. And this is how we try and balance. We keep this list. So we basically we build funnels and we try to see what is the efficiency of the funnels. So on one side, our industry lives and dies, I think, by the creativity and by the ability to push through barriers. Like there was no hybrid, now we have hybrid. There was no hyper casual, it happened. And if you went with it and try to understand where it's going and how you can tap into it, you gained. It was really, really good for you. But you need to do it within the context of operating your business and being focused in how to get to be successful. I think there are very smart people in gaming globally, and I listen to some of them. Also, Ilka from Supercell was in one of the Google Play events. And I think basically all these people are saying that releasing now new games became harder. So yeah. The kind of common thing I've been hearing, and by the way, I agree, in all levels of games, that if 15 years ago, you just had a cool idea and a nice team, sometimes you might have had some success. 5 years ago, if you were good on most of the aspects, live ops, execution, marketing, and just excellent in one of them, you could have done a successful game. Today, to launch a successful game, you need to be excellent in all of these. So it takes focus, like you just said. So, for example, we have a top five list that we distribute and update on a monthly basis. These are the top five games globally for our organization, that if anyone has a question between a game and another game, then he goes by the list. And if it's the game in the top five and not in the top five, then the answer is obvious. But yeah, besides it's this top five, we are working in parallel on another 100 games. But so this is the creative part, but then people just have to take it forward. So from all of this funnel every month, by the way, it doesn't change every month. Some months are just the same with the top five, and some the top five changed. And for example, in this in December and January, we're going to start scaling. Hopefully, we're in the process of scaling around six games. I don't expect all of them to scale. It doesn't happen. You don't have the odds, but we have six games that reached promising status. They're all ROAS positive in small scale, and we are slowly trying to move them and to see whether it's just a golden cohort thing and it's going to get blocked when we start scaling them, or they're actually going to scale. And this is all the focus and the creativity kind of balance. So trying to keep that is very, very complicated.
Nice. Well, you heard it here first, folks. That's really interesting to know. So another question I sort of wanted to ask you, Sagi. The mobile games industry, right? We're constantly evolving in terms of monetization models. What are some of the biggest challenges you faced in this realm, and how are you adapting to these trends? Do you have any sort of advice out there for those who might be struggling within this part of mobile game development?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I think monetization evolves, but not that much. I mean, the logic, yeah, you have more subtypes. So in RVs, you get more sophisticated, which RVs and how to attach them and how to assign them. The same a little bit in inters, in-apps or in-apps. I think the main thing for us is, and the main kind of acknowledgement is that You've built games for ads or games for in-apps, and then you try to add the other one as a kind of maybe it will be lucky, or just as I'll have 5% or 10% more. We build games, especially in hybrid, we look at the economy and we say, let's build a solid economy, a virtual economy to start with, that doesn't tap into the monetization for a second. If it makes sense and you build a journey, a user journey for the users, where sometimes he needs more and sometimes he's getting it, and and you build the right things and the right funnels around that, then I think you can add properly and you can play with anything around in-apps and RVs that will give you the right outcome. And then if you feel the audience, if this is a game or the audience is more prone, or the geo, by the way, is more prone towards RV, then you can tweak it so that RV will be good enough because it gives you smaller quantities in the economy. Or if you want to pressure on the in-app side, then you can make the balance there. But I think it all comes because I've seen games in the past, they were either, so you were really optimizing the in-apps and they gave you thing, and then you added some RVs in different places just to have, so on the lives on something, but it wasn't part of a balanced economy. Right now we're looking first at what is the game economy? How do we see the balancing of it in terms of the user journey, and then adding all the monetization? And lastly, because I think that also there are a lot of people I heard talking about, it's the wrong thing trying to pressure, because in many cases we want to push the game down the funnel. We have a game and we want the KPIs to keep on improving. So we put monetization too early. The game has to be fun first. People have to play it longer term first. You have to solve your game and product problems first, including the economy. If that is solved and you have players coming in and playing and decent retention, then you can add monetization and hopefully you can get into, obviously the marketing is at least 50% of the equation today. So you might build an amazing game, 1,000 player would really, you know, do anything in that, but cannot grow, cannot scale. But assuming you've built that part and then you added monetization, then you need to face, or in parallel, you face the marketing. But I believe that, for example, in many cases, we saw the teams adding too early inters and banners or whatever. So you first need to build a good core, add some, add the envelope and the ability to balance and play with the economy. Then when you see the numbers and you see players happy with the game, you can now start pushing for in-apps and RVs. And only when you're close to release, you can consider whether, and if it's suitable, inters and what will be the value and how they will compete or what they will do with others. I think that at least for us, this is the right order of things, not to try and just, you know, tweak the numbers, make the player value look good, but it will not scale when we will start scaling the game. So that's
interesting stuff. So, and you gave me a little bit of a precursor to my next question for you. You said that there was a time where, you know, you could be just good at live ops, you could just be good at admin, but now it's a case of having to be excellent at everything. So competition in this space is only growing. How do you think companies can differentiate themselves, especially in the more casual gaming space?
In hybrid casual, I think that the competition is growing. They're amazing. We have amazing competition, Voodoo and Say Games and Rolic and the really smart, talented folks. But this is good. It keeps us better. So if we didn't need to compete, it was problematic. So you're right. There are great games. We learn from them. We try then to find our niche places where we think we can be better. So it all comes also with our DNA. I think we ask about casual. So here the answer, at least for us, is pretty straightforward. By the way, in casual, it's extremely hard to launch a new game. There, the amounts of capital you need to align when the ROAS kind of moves to, I don't know, 9 months, 12 months, whatever. Cost per acquisition is expensive in casual. It can get to $20 again, 15. So imagine just how much you're outlining in the beginning when you're paying for users that you only monetize, you only get back 20% because you're still learning. You don't have the full game. So a casual is complicated. Our what we believe that we are getting. So in casual or in mainly gaming, a lot of the teams are male led. So, and then it goes either to shooters or male kind of dominated games in sense of players. And then you have the puzzles, which are 50-50. Some of them are themed puzzle with fashion or whatever. And then maybe it skews a bit more, but most of the, so if you look at players, female players on mobile are more than male players. If you look at monetization, they pay more. I think it's the lack of teams that are built from female leadership, that they are the game owners and they constitute the game design and most of the team. Not that, you know, guys cannot create great games for women. I think it's just the state of mind. You do
Right.
best what you want to play. So if you want to play dress up, then you can, whatever gender you are, you can build a great game. So we since our heritage was also around the kind of girl games in the beginning, which evolved into fashion games. So we have a good expertise in fashion simulation. We launched in the past in 2017 Super Stylist, which has over 150 million downloads. It's a nice game that did tens of millions of dollars, but it was kept in some abilities. And we have an all-star, mostly women-led game with
I love that.
She's in the UK. Yar is the game owner, and the game designer is Elise, an Australian living in Germany.
Yeah.
And we have a team. So it's a female all-star team that is leading what they're passionate about, which is doing a fashion game. It's the new installment is called Glow. And by the way, the game is already profitable in soft launch, and we're going actually to full launch it in 9th of December. So that's going to be our hopefully big casual success. And I think why it's interesting, because this market is still not that red ocean. While, you know, if you look at Match 3, you look at the Merge, you look at many of the other aspects, they're heavily, heavily, heavily red ocean. By the way, it doesn't mean that a new player cannot push his way into it, but it's actually push his way. He needs to be better in everything, plus align huge amounts of capital just to try and sustain the amount of force he needs to build a really great game, do UA until it becomes hopefully profitable with long-term cohorts. So it's a big undertaking. And we believe that for us, this niche of fashion simulation can be a huge place to succeed where there aren't a lot of competitors.
Right. I love that line. I love that you guys are sort of staying authentic as well. You said that who better to understand a game than someone who would actually, or develop a game than someone who would actually play it? I mean, you can't get more right than that, to be honest.
Yeah, we usually, in every aspect, also in hybrid, we ask the teams what they want. The decision to stop doing hyper, for example, was that when we prepared the budget for the year and what's the plans and so on, we felt that the managers, while they put some targets on hyper, because we asked them kind of from bottom to top down, we felt that they are not aligned with that. What they really want to chase are hybrid. So we changed the plans. We said, if you want to do hybrid, then let's see which subgenres and what is the method. But yeah, let's, by all means, because I don't think this is an industry where you try to achieve your games. You need to dream big, and you need to be very passionate. I think without passion in our industry, it's really hard to, it's not a very technical thing to move, I don't know, just numbers. Yeah, it's data-driven, but it's a lot about the quality of execution, and you need to play your game day in, day out. And if you don't like your game, you will not play it. You will not understand the players you're trying to bring. So it's destined to fail, in my view. So
absolutely.
Yeah, if you own a game or you're part of a game team, you need to play it. You need to play it a lot. And so, and you like it. If you suffer, then you are not in the right game or in the right industry.
Absolutely. I love that. So the gaming industry, in every industry, as we know it, is kind of seeing shifts with technology. You know, we can't really have this conversation without really touching on things like AI, even AR, perhaps even blockchain and, you know, elements to do with crypto. How is Crazy Labs positioning itself to explore these different types of technologies? And what do you believe will have the most significant impact on the mobile gaming industry within the next decade? Perhaps it is AI, perhaps it isn't. What are your thoughts on that?
So blockchain, we stayed away. By the way, in the past, we used to be early adopters of a lot of things, and we discovered one that it's not always smart, because it's rarely that you get a lot of benefit from being the early, early adopter. In many cases, it's just that you were there, but it stopped and you put a lot of effort when you shouldn't have. By the way, the biggest thing we had, for example, it's not a well-known fact, but Amazon, at some point, I think it was 2014, something like that, they released a new 3D phone, which had four cameras, and it had like, it's like a hologram. It showed you in certain positions. It was called a 3D phone. We needed to sign like 1,000 secrecy protocols and forms just to get the phone, and we were one of the early developers to adjust, because you needed even to adjust the icons on the store, and it was a lot of work. And I even got my edition of the phone. I think I still have it. I got it like you get something like in a secret
yeah.
service movie. So, you know. So,
yeah, like a spy movie.
Yeah, and the phone sold maybe 1,000 copies or something. It was a big. So we wasted huge amounts of time and energy. And you know, there was AR and VR and stuff like that. So we learned through the years that one, our focus is on where we're doing great. So there you can innovate around the genres, or when hyper turned into hybrid, and we went fast into that. Now, so blockchain, we'll see. The jury is still out. And you know, maybe it will just be something that it suits other types of games, other types of players. I'm not sure. Same as AR, VR, still. But AI is a tool and an ability which is an underlying infrastructure. So it's not something specific, by the way, to gaming. And yeah. And we saw how in graphic design and 3D and narrative and translation, it already became something which is usable. So there we are testing, we created an AI department in the company to push to, and by the way, we put specific targets for the managers that we want them to be AI early adopters in the sense of trying a lot of tools. Now, obviously in AI, there are a lot of regulation issues and other issues, but what we don't want as a company to find out that some sales person comes to us and tells us, look, all your competitors are already using it in production. They get 30% or 50%. Now, please use it. This is a situation we will not be in and we can't be in. So we want to be here, yes, we will spend the time and waste time and energy to try things very early, to try
Absolutely.
And understand.
So you guys don't want to be reactive to things. You kind of want to be ahead of the trend.
Yeah, in AI. In the other places, we just want to be reactive. When it's successful, call us.
Right. Yeah. I love that. So mobile gaming generates billions globally, as we all know. And my last question for you, Yosagi, and a bit of a bit of future gazing globally. So what kind of, how do you see market dynamics shifting geographically? Are there any particular regions that you believe are poised for significant growth in the mobile gaming sector?
You know, all the Google and Apple are much better suited than me. You know, there's India that obviously everyone is talking about that is growing, and Indonesia, that part. Interestingly enough, I will just answer about it. Maybe you didn't ask about it, but I look at the evolution of where great teams grow, because, you know, we find great teams, we work with great teams on the publishing. And you know, countries like, you know, US, for example, France, Germany, Israel, many other countries, gaming is just one of the things great people can do, but they also have AI and cyber and SaaS and what have you. So it's hard in these countries, top talents, only X percent of it goes into gaming. What we found out, and this is really interesting, you look at the wave that were countries that were kind of great talents went mobile first. So Finland was one of these countries, and then you see the evolution, Supercell and Rovio and companies like that. You see also, by the way, in Sweden, so all the Nordics. Then you see Turkey, which, wow, what amazing gaming industry. Yeah. I think it's where VC will spend most money on gaming than any other place. You also have, I think, in Belarus and also early companies. And we see now this potential coming also in Vietnam. Vietnam is becoming a huge hub for gaming.
Yeah.
Big companies there by itself, but also great developers. You see a lot of talent that is educated and goes into the really great universities. They go and they specialize in gaming because it's for them very interesting. There is a lot of culture there around gaming, and we see and work with, we have a hub, by the way, where we work with the developers and improve them, and this is a kind of a 3-month program. So we already had the hub in Vietnam once. We had it in different places in the world, and we see in Vietnam, the potential is just huge. So if you ask me about where is the best gaming empire is going to come, it's, I think, from Vietnam. A lot of great companies already rise, but
interesting
more to come from Vietnam in terms
really,
of
really interesting
gaming companies.
Fantastic stuff. Well, Sagi, really, really, thank you so much for a fantastic, insightful discussion. I've had so much fun talking to you.
Me too. Thank you very much for having me. And thank you.
Thank you for everyone listening. That was it for this week's Mobilize and Monetize podcast. Until next time.